When I was 16, I was at college and it was a Friday. And one of my mates said to his group of friends that he's going home. He had a massive headache. We thought he was just pulling another sickie. Monday morning rolled around, our tutor Jeff called the class together and told us our friend had had a bleed on the brain. He was put on life support, but over the weekend they'd pulled the plug and he had died. And he was 17. Or there was Gina, one of Abby's flatmates at university. Half Italian, beautiful, bubbly, full of joy. And a couple of years after uni, Abby got a text. Gina had died. She was in her 20s. Or there was my friend Jamie, a great rugby player. He got injured in a game, took a dodgy tackle, had a season of headaches, and suddenly he died. Or there was our deacon at church who got diagnosed with cancer in July, and he just died. Or you turn to the book of Genesis, you read chapter 5, and you get the refrain, and he died, and he died, and he died. We live in the relative safety and comfort of the West, and it has lulled us into a false sense of security. Each one of us here this evening think we've got time. But then you get those moments, don't you? You get the Jota football player moments where a young man's life is snuffed out, and we think for a moment of the fragility and the fragile nature of life. But then we think, that's never going to be me. And so people gamble their eternities away with a false sense of facade. They've got time. Time to get right with God. Time to think about these things at the end of life. And while people will never say it with their words, many people live like the thief on the cross. They think, I'll think about these things on my deathbed. I'll think about them at the end. That is the level of complacency that many of us have. And I come this evening to shake you. To shake you out of that complacency, because here's the thing, the Lord has not promised any one of us tomorrow. Think of Simeon. He was promised that he would not die until he saw Jesus Christ in the flesh. God has not made that promise to you. None of us know if we're going to be here tomorrow. So time and time again, Jesus in the Gospels calls us to salvation today. There are, in a sense, right now, two clocks that are ticking down. There is the clock of your life. It started at the moment you were born. And there will come a day where the clock strikes zero. And when it does, your time is up. Then there's another clock. A clock that was set in motion long ago. A clock that speaks of the return of Jesus Christ. And when that clock strikes zero, time itself will be up. And friends, here's the humbling truth. We do not know which clock will strike zero first, and we don't know when that will be. Here Jesus is speaking in this passage about the coming of the king and the end of the age. And notice with me what he says in verse 32. But concerning that day or that hour, no one knows. Not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Jesus here is talking to his disciples. The context, if you have your Bible open, is that Jesus has been in the temple courts. Back in chapter 12, there's that beautiful scene of the widow's offering. And then we read in chapter 1 something important there in verse 1. As he, speaking of the Lord Jesus, came out of the temple. Christ here is in the temple with his disciples. They've seen him ministering. Then he leaves the temple. And that description is not just a narrative description. It becomes deeply symbolic. So that soon in Mark's gospel, Christ physically leaving the temple will become for us a prophetic picture of the fact that God's presence will soon leave that temple. So that the physical departure of Christ foreshadows the reality that God will soon move his dwelling place. For in just a matter of days in Mark's gospel, the temple as the people have known it will go into shutdown mode. While the temple will still be there for another 40 years after the death of Christ, it is no longer the place where God dwells in the midst of his people. The cross has redirected that. The temple fulfills its purpose. It will come to an end. But as Jesus leaves the temple with the disciples, notice in chapter 13 and verse 1, the disciples are struck by this sense of awe and grandeur. They're saying to Jesus, look at this building, Jesus. Look at these beautiful stones, the magnificent craftsmanship. Look around. And they were right. It was a beautiful building. The temple was one of the great wonders of the Roman world. It was, in many ways, a masterpiece. It was draped in limestone. It was covered in gold. It glistened in the sunlight as it sat gloriously up on Mount Zion. But if Jesus' disciples thought that would excite Jesus, notice that his response then leaves them flabbergasted. Because what does he say, verse 2? And Jesus said to them, do you see these great buildings? They will not be left here, one stone upon another. That will not be thrown down. Jesus says this temple will not be here for much longer. And while his disciples could never have believed it, in around 40 years' time, the unthinkable would happen. The Roman general Titus would march into the city of Jerusalem, and the city that once sang with songs of worship will soon be surrounded by iron and fire. Josephus, that ancient historian who saw the siege with his own eyes, tells us it was beyond imagining. Famine gripped the city. People turned against each other just to survive. Parents buried their children. The streets ran with blood, and a million lives fell to the fury of Rome. And finally, when the Romans broke through the city walls, they torched the place. And Titus had ordered his men not to touch the temple, but so consumed with rage and anger and greed that they defiled his orders. They tore the temple down stone by stone. They looted its treasures and they left it a smouldering, burning mess. The place where heaven had once touched earth was flattened, desecrated and gone. Not one stone was left on another. It was the end of an era, and it has never been built again. And for Jesus' disciples, these words would have been shocking and stunning and unthinkable. So as we move to verse 3, notice what happens. Jesus and his few of his closest disciples, they climb the Mount of Olives. And from that high vantage point, like on the picture behind me, imagine that's Dunstable, they look out and they can see the temple glistening in the sunlight. It is draped in gold and marble. It catches the sun for miles around, and they feel the weight of Jesus' words. They're trying to get their head around it. Jesus, that temple, our temple, gone. They're going to hardly believe it. So verse 4, they ask the question, burning in their minds, tell us when these things will be and what will be the sign when all these things are about to be accomplished. And in verse 5 onwards, Jesus begins to talk to them about the destruction of the temple, a date that would come 40 years later. But his words, as we know, go beyond speaking of the end of the temple. He speaks of the end of the age. There's a dual perspective in the words of Jesus. There's a near fulfillment and a far one. And so Jesus is preparing his disciples in this generation for the end of the temple, and he's preparing his disciples today for the end of the age. Here in Mark 13, he tells his disciples things that they are to be about and things they are not to be about. So there in Mark chapter 13, he calls his disciples not to be deceived. There will be false messiahs who will come along who claim to be Christ himself. And history will tell us there has been over 70 men throughout the history of the world who have thought they themselves were the Messiah, and they have led people astray. Jesus says, do not be deceived. Secondly, he says, do not be alarmed. You will look around and you will see wars and you will see rumours of wars, but the end is not yet here. Do not be deceived. Do not be alarmed, but instead be on guard. You will go before leaders and governors in verse 9. You will stand and be beaten in synagogues. So be on guard. And in all of that, he says to them, verse 10, be proclaiming the gospel. The gospel must be proclaimed to all the nations. And I want us to particularly focus on the words that Jesus says towards the end of the passage that Jeff read for us. And a call to be aware. To be aware. Some things don't transpose from one context to another very well, do they? I want you to imagine one of those big churches, maybe a church in America. You've got hundreds, thousands of people gathering, and you've probably seen it or experienced it in these big churches. You get the typical countdown screen before the service. Eventually, the clock comes from 10 to 9 to 8, and when it hits zero, a band kicks in, the lights go up, the service begins with this kind of flair to it. And sometimes you get a young pastor who sees something of that and thinks, wow, that's what we need. So he takes it back to his little village church. The wonky projector screen goes up. He's downloaded from Clipart a countdown, and then the clock hits zero. The elderly deacon makes their way to the lectern, opens his notes, reads through every single announcement. The ladies will be meeting at 3 o'clock on Monday at Nancy's house to raise money for the church roof. Really doesn't have the same flair. Notice with me, our passage has told us from the very beginning of creation, there has been a countdown clock set in motion. And when it strikes zero, the curtain of history will come to an end and Christ will return in power and in glory. That is what the Lord Jesus has alluded to in verse 24 to 27 of our passage. Now, if you're anything like me, I love to know things. I like to track the weather. I like to plan my diary. My preaching schedule at the church in Ancon Street is set for the next 2 years. I love control. We crave certainty. But here Jesus is pulling the rug beneath our feet. He's telling us that that countdown clock, the heavenly one, no one knows when it's going to strike zero except one. Look at verse 32 again. But concerning that day or that hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. Jesus' words there debunk every single prophecy that has ever been made about the exact day of Jesus' return. You would have seen it, I have seen it, men who stand up in front of the people of God with charts and big timelines. And they say, this is the year, this is the day, this is the hour. But Jesus says in this very passage, do not be deceived. Anyone who stands before the people of God and says, this is the year, this is the day, this is the hour, Jesus says here, they are a false prophet. Secondly, depending on where your eschatology might land, you might look around and you might see, as this passage even talks about, you might see wars and rumours of wars and think that the end is near. But do not confuse nearness with nowness. Do not assume that because you see a sign, the countdown clock has finished. And secondly, or thirdly, Jesus' words here, let's be honest, they're a bit of a head scratcher, aren't they? Scholars have wrestled with this verse for literally thousands of years. How can Christ, who is God, say that he does not know the will of the Father? And some have shared, well, maybe it's that in emptying himself, in becoming human, emptying himself in those words of Philippians 2, taking on limitations, it meant that in his humanity he did not know. And there may be some truth in that. But here's the danger. We can get so caught up in the theology of this verse that we miss what Jesus is saying. Jesus is saying to us, listen, if the angels don't know, if I don't know, if no one else in all creation and heaven does not know except the Father, then my disciples, you have no idea. And that is not a call to passivity. It's a call to a level of vigilance. We do not know the whole picture, so the posture of a disciple of Jesus must be one of watchfulness. For notice how the passage continues. We transition from verse 32 into verse 33. Be on guard. Keep awake. For you do not know when the time will come. It is like a man going on a journey when he leaves home and puts his servants in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to stay awake. Therefore stay awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come, in the evening or at midnight, or when the cock crows, or in the morning, lest he come suddenly and find you asleep. Jesus is talking into a particular context here. Back, if you know Mark's gospel well, you will know back in chapter 12, he had told the parable of the tenants, a parable that cut straight to the heart of Israel's leadership. He exposed the leaders of the people, men who had been trusted to care for the vineyard, as those who had abused it. Men who were meant to cultivate in the nation faith and justice and righteousness, men who were meant to tend the vineyard of the nation for the glory of God, had corrupted the vineyard. They had dishonored his servants. They had abused his servants, the prophets, mocking them, beating them, and casting them out. And there in the passage in Mark 12, standing now before them in the parable, was the beloved son, the heir of it all, and in the passage they were about to kill him. It was a devastating picture. God's chosen leaders had rejected God's chosen son. It was the very thing happening in the life and teaching of Jesus. And as the passage goes on, we see because of their rejection, because of their hard-hearted rebellion, Jesus makes it clear they themselves will be rejected and the vineyard will be taken from them and be given to others. And now here in chapter 13, Jesus picks up that thread and he makes a connection by way of contrast. So back in chapter 12, the tenants were unfaithful. While the master was away, Jesus now calls his disciples to a level of faithfulness. The tenants had rejected the son, but Jesus' disciples are called to watch and wait and be prepared for the coming of the son. So that in that sense, if Mark 12 exposes the failure of Israel's leadership, here in Mark 13, Jesus is calling his new humanity, his disciples, to a level of stewardship. Jesus is saying to his disciples, do not repeat their mistake. Do not fall asleep at your post. Do not forget who the vineyard belongs to. You have been entrusted with it now, so be ready for the master's return. And so the point he's making in all of this is Jesus in this passage in Mark 13, he's already told us that he's going to come back. So this illustration about the steward and the house becomes unmistakable. The master has gone away, but his departure is not final. He will return, and that truth shapes everything. It shapes the posture of a disciple's heart to be one of readiness and faithfulness. For think about it, friends, right now in heaven, there is a sense in which the Son has his hand on the doorknob of eternity. And he is simply waiting for the Father to say, and go now, my son. And when that moment comes, we do not know. Verse 32 tells us it could be today. It could be tomorrow. It could be 10,000 years from now. So in light of that uncertainty, what should be the posture of our hearts as disciples? Watchfulness. And what should be the posture of the heart of the non-Christian? Repentance. For notice how the passage ends in verse 37. And what I say to you, I say to all, stay awake. Jesus here is not just talking to his disciples, he's talking to all, he's talking to everyone. He is crying out from this passage to all humanity, watch, be alert, be awake, be ready. And I want us to think about how we are to take those words from three different perspectives. So first of all, for those of us who would claim to be Christians, followers of Christ, these words are words given to sleepy Christians. For notice here, Jesus is very clear. He's talking on the Mount of Olives to his disciples, his followers. Yet he calls his disciples to be awake, to be watchful, to be prepared, to be sober-minded. And interestingly, what's going to happen in the very next passage? Where will Jesus find his disciples? Sleeping. Mark chapter 14, verse 37, then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. The master has gone away in his garden. He has gone away to pray and he has returned and he has found his disciples sleeping. Simon, he said to Peter, are you asleep? Could you not keep watch for 1 hour? Watch and pray so that you do not fall into temptation. And brothers and sisters, if followers of Jesus Christ then, who had physically walked with him for years, needed to hear this call to wake up, then how much more do we? For if they got sleepy in their garden as they waited the return of the Master, then be sure we get sleepy. Because we know throughout the history of the church, over 2,000 years, the church has this habit of getting spiritually sleepy. And interestingly, it is often the churches that are most prosperous physically that tend to be the most spiritually sleepy. And we need to hear that desperately in the West. Because we have lived so much of our lives in safety and security that we have begun to think the Christian life is one where comfort is normal and suffering is strange. But that has never been the story of the church. You read Acts and it is often faith is forged at its best in the fires of persecution. Consider the 7 letters to the churches in Revelation. It is the churches that are prospering the most, like Laodicea, who from the outward perspective look blessed. They are wealthy, they are comfortable. But Christ walks amongst his lampstands, he sees his church and he gives them the diagnosis, you are spiritually sleepy. You are lukewarm. You make me sick. Meanwhile, the church that endures the most persecution, who experiences the hardest level of poverty in Smyrna, they receive no rebuke. Their king simply calls them to be faithful. Friends, is that reminder that persecution strengthens and shapens the people of God in a way that comfort never can? And that is still true today. I am guessing right now our brothers and sisters meeting underground in Afghanistan are more in tune to spiritual realities than you and I are. So particularly for us in the safety of the West, we need to hear this call from our Master. Christ is saying to his church, be alert, be attentive, be aware, Dunstable Baptist Church, says your King. This is a call from our Saviour to drive out lukewarmness and sleepiness from his people as they await the second advent. But then secondly, notice Jesus' words cut not only to the heart of his disciples, but what we might call nominal Christianity. I, the other week, had the privilege of going into a local school to hand out some Bibles near Tring. And increasingly, as you go into schools, you will be very aware that the historical Christian ethos has gone in much of our schools. Our young people growing up today do not really know much of the story of the Bible. I remember once talking to someone and they thought Noah's Ark was just a Disney film. And that is a sad thing. But it also is a reminder that actually with nominal Christianity there has been many blessings, but there have been many curses. Because many people have lived with a sense of thinking they are Christians because they go to church. Look at this passage. Jesus here is very clear. His words are cutting. Be on guard. Be alert. Keep watch. This is not an if. This is not a maybe when it's convenient or comfortable. But now, Christ is calling out to the people, to everyone, as verse 37 says. And everyone needs to hear this message because the reality is there are some people who think they are on guard, but they are not. There are some people who think they are ready for the second advent, but they are not. There are some people who think they're watchful, but they are not. There are some people who think they are a Christian, but they are not. And how do we know? Because Jesus will tell us so. Not everyone who calls me Lord, Lord will enter the kingdom of heaven. Friends, some people think they are ready for this day. Some people have been sitting in churches for decades and they think they are ready. They think they're fine, but they are going to wake up the other side of eternity with the shock of their life. You sat in church gatherings, but I never knew you. You played church on a Sunday, but I never knew you. You got baptized as a child, but I never knew you. You went to a Grace Baptist church, but I never knew you. Jesus is saying, do not assume on appearances. Do not trust in your routine or reputation. The thing that matters is your relationship with me. Because remember who Jesus has recently talked to in Mark's gospel. That rich young ruler. He had a great reputation. He was keeping all of the commands, interestingly, that everyone else could see. But the ones that no one else could see, he was not keeping. He was not loving the Lord his God with all of his heart, which is why he wanted to keep his wealth. Jesus is saying your reputation is not enough. It is your heart that I want. So wake up. And I love this about Charles Spurgeon, that brilliant preacher. He would often pray that his own elders would come to faith in Jesus Christ, just to be sure. He understood the seriousness of this call. So we must not assume. One of the things that grieves me sometimes about modern evangelism is we've created this idea that if you pray a prayer once, you're automatically a Christian. That if you mutter a few words and invite Jesus into your heart at a youth camp when you're 10 and tired, or you pray the sinner's prayer on your front door to stop that Christian from the church around the corner, keep knocking at dinner time. But friends, should it not be concerning to us that we never read anywhere in the New Testament language of inviting Jesus into your heart, of praying a sinner's prayer? Rather, the Bible is clear, isn't it? The perseverance of the saints will be seen in those who persevere, who run the good race, who fight the good fight, who keep the faith. And this is the danger, therefore, with modern evangelism. Because we tell people, you pray a prayer, you invite Jesus into your life, that guarantees everything is fine between you and God for the rest of your days. But that faith has no impact on their life. They're just nominal Christians. But they assume they're a Christian because they prayed a prayer. Now that is not me saying, and hear me well, that is not me saying a genuine believer can lose their salvation. No, Romans 8, nothing can snatch you out of God's hands, so you can be pretty confident you can't even jump. But let's be clear, if a prayer saves you, a formula of a prayer, that is not ultimately Christianity. It is superstition dressed up in church clothes. Not everyone who calls me Lord, Lord will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. First, Jesus calls his people to wake up. Wake up from that spiritual sleepiness. Secondly, there's a call for us in that sense to wake up from a false sense of assurance, of people who think they're a Christian just because they live in a Christian country. And thirdly, there's a call for the non-Christian to wake up, to turn from life to, or from death to life. We spend much of our lives planning and preparing, don't we? What we'll do next week, what we will be doing for Christmas, maybe even in the rain, you've got your summer holiday booked for next year. And there's nothing wrong with plans. The problem comes when we think our plans are guarantees. But again, as we said at the start, God has not promised any one of us tomorrow. That is why the Lord calls us to salvation. Everyone in this room is divided into one of two camps. We are either asleep or we are awake. And here's the thing, whether it's God's eschatological countdown clock or the countdown clock of your own life, one day the clock will strike zero. And each of us will wake up on the other side of eternity and we will be found to have been asleep or awake. And in that moment, there's now no second chance. There's no rewind button. There's no let me do my time again. No, you're either asleep or awake. Or as Jesus says in Matthew 7, you've either lived your life on the broad road or the narrow road. Jesus here is pleading in this verse for people to stay awake. And friends, remember the words of this one, because Jesus is the only one who has come from the other side back. He knows what is going to come after this trumpet call. So he says, be watchful, be alert, be awake. Right now in the throne room of God, the Son of Man has his hand on the doorknob, waiting for the Father to say, and go. And when that moment will be, the curtain of history will come to a close. Christ will return in power and glory. He will come on the clouds of heaven, and he will come, as the Apostles' Creed says, to judge the living and the dead. And as this passage says in verse 27, he will gather his elect from the four corners of the earth. And who are his elect? In that sense, they are the awake, the alert, the aware. If you look around in our society right now, everyone is getting ready for the first advent, for Christmas. Lights are going up, calendars are filling out. Many parents over the next couple of days will be so thankful for Amazon Prime. Children are starting preparing in the way that they can. Tiny hearts beginning to straighten up because they know that something big is coming. For some, it's the ever-old parenting warning, keep that up and there'll be no presents under the tree. So they start to prepare. They get themselves ready. And we're doing the same. We're booking our Tesco slots. We're planning our diaries. We're getting ready for a particular day that feels warm and huge and magical. But Mark 13 reminds us there is another day to be prepared for. And that day is coming. And that day is closer now than it was at the start of this service. The clock is ticking down. And unbelief will not stop the clock from ticking. Theological debates and timelines and charts will not stop it. Ignorance will not stop it. Denial will not stop it. One day the clock will strike zero. And the question is, on that day, will you be found to be awake? Will it be for you, as our last song puts it, the hope of heaven or the fear of hell?